Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. If y'all are like us, you've exhausted everywhere else you find your documentaries on the strange and unusual and the fun. And if you like grand conspiracies and more breakaway societies, paranormal, ancient civilizations like we all do, and UFOs, well, we found the place right at your fingertips, folks. You can stream videos from anywhere, from your living room or on the go, with access to over 7,000 titles, all on Gaia.com, G-A-I-A. Now, you can get this for a monthly plan of $9.95 a month. Your first month will only be 99 cents. Now, there is a three-month plan and an annual plan. So, if you're into the things that we're into, and judging by what you're listening to, you are, start enjoying Gaia.com. Expand your perspective even more. G-A-I-A.com.
And this episode is made possible by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Go to blueapron.com today to sign up. They offer two plans to choose from, a two-person plan or a family plan that serves up to four people. Depending on the plan you choose, each week you receive 2 to 4 custom refrigerated boxes packed with ice packs and insulated liners to ensure your ingredients stay fresh. Also, complete step-by-step instructions informing you how to prepare each meal. Each week, they offer different meals, and you pick which ones you want sent to you on the website. Shipping is always free, and you can skip any week you want, and you can cancel any time. Go to blueapron.com today to get started. All new chefs get $30 off your first delivery. Blueapron.com.
What's going on, friends? And thanks again for listening to us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, sitting across the desk with his, the hell he's got a selfie stick at, is mi amigo, the selfie master, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm super thrilled to be here. I do have a selfie stick here. There's no phone or nothing on it. It's just laying here on the desk here. I just picked it up and started playing with it while you were reading. I was trying to disrupt your flow.
Now tell people exactly what you use that for, because it's not selfies. You use it at work, actually.
That's right. I'm a state certified real estate appraiser, and so I go look at homes all day long. And depending on the type of loan people are getting, sometimes they want photographs of the attic. Well, not all homes have pull down stairs to get into the attic, and instead of carrying around an expensive foldable, you know, collapsible aluminum ladder, those things are like $400.
Now, you carry your normal DSLR with you, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But For the attic work, you can do this.
I put my iPhone on my selfie stick, and I stick the selfie stick up in the attic and take the pictures. Or if it's a peer and beam home, stick the selfie stick underneath in the crawl space. I don't have to get down there with the spiders and stuff.
Good thinking.
So I use the selfie stick in a practical way, not just for looking at myself.
Whoa. What are you saying? Not looking at yourself's not practical? Come on.
No, I don't like to look at myself, especially in photographs.
That's good, because nobody likes to look at you.
I don't blame them.
I don't like to. I have to sit across the desk from you. Hey, I got something fun here. First of all, we're recording all this in a hurricane. We weren't prepared for the December rains. In that cold December
rain. Man, it is raining, right?
It come blasting in on us today. So if you hear anything in the background, it may be thunder or rain or whatnot going on. But I've got something fun here. Look, folks, we all like to drink. Well, at least, you know, water or whatnot. But this is going to be cold beers. This is going to be alcohol, people. This comes from the BBC.com. And this is interesting when I saw this. And I want to bring it up to you, Philly, because this is just something cool. It says alcohol actually flips the brain into hungry mode.
Really?
Yeah, so like when you're drinking. Now, I was always like, man, I can't eat anything. I'm full. You know, you drink those beers. Listen to this. It says, in tests on mice, alcohol activated the brain signals that tell the body to eat more food. Now, there's some UK researchers, and they report their findings to the Journal of Nature Communications. And I believe it's to say they believe it's going to be the same as in humans. And it said it would explain why people say they eat more when they've had a few drinks. They said, rather than the loss of restraint, it's a neuronal response. And the Francis Crick Institute team is the ones reporting on this, as the mice were given generous doses of alcohol for 3 days. So hopefully when you and I come back reincarnated, we're going to be reincarnated as beer drinking mice. But a dose being equivalent to around 18 units or a bottle and a half of wine per person. Okay.
So okay.
That's kind of what this dose equals to, I guess, the weight size of these mice.
Right.
And it says that it increased the activity in neurons called the AGRP. And these are the neurons that are fired when the body experiences starvation.
Huh.
So the alcohol actually does that. It says the researchers repeated this experiment, but blocked the neurons with the drug, and the mice didn't eat as much, which the research say suggests that those neurons are responsible for alcohol-induced eating. It says alcohol, of course, contains a lot of calories. A large glass of wine says contain as many calories as a donut. I had no idea.
Really?
Of something. That's what they're claiming. Now, there's a professor there, Sir Ian Gilmore from the Alcohol Health Alliance in the UK, said people should be made aware of the impact alcohol can have on how much they eat and what they eat, along with the associated health risks of the alcohol. This is what he says. Alcohol is responsible for over 60 illnesses and conditions on its own, and drinkers place themselves at even greater risk when their drinking is combined with overeating, especially because when people drink, they're more likely to make less healthy food choices. Alcohol and obesity cause 90% of liver deaths, and alcohol is twice as toxic to the liver in very obese patients.
Really?
Now, that's crazy. That's something I never really put two and two together, because it's always one of those, you know, I always talk about it. When you go get like some enchiladas or fajitas or something, there's nothing goes better with them than like a cold beer.
I agree.
The beer is perfect. I mean, you can go margarita, a marg if you want. I prefer on the rocks. But I like a cold beer with it. And even sometimes when I have some pizza, I like a cold beer with it. But when I go out and have like fajitas, it's cold beer all the way. I never knew that it was one of those things that makes you want to eat more.
I think that's probably a broad generalization. For me, I will say that it's not that way. When I drink, I don't want to eat.
That's me. I don't really notice
that. There's oftentimes where I've started grilling. Like I'm drinking beer and grilling, and I'm grilling a lot of food.
I know where you're going.
It takes like 2 hours to get into it. By the time I'm done, I'm like, well, I'm not even hungry now.
Yeah, I'm done with
it. I'm filled up on the beer. That's happened numerous times.
Yeah.
But for most people, I guess that's what happens.
Well, we don't know. Like you said, that is a very broad generalization, but they have noticed that on mice, and that's what they all say in here. They don't say that it guarantees it. Remember what they say?
Yeah.
But they say that they would explain why they think that people would do it. They believe it is probably true in humans as well. So that's what they're going to start looking into and see. Look, it's not like one bad decision leads to another. That'd be amazing. I'm not only am I going to drink a sixer, I'm going to eat four cheeseburgers, you know, or something.
Well, I definitely agree. If you've been drinking and imbibing for quite a while, that you're going to make poor choices when it comes to food. When it comes just about everything,
I make poor choices on food, but I'm totally sober, so I don't need help on the beer.
You'll drop stuff on the ground. Don't matter. You just eat it.
That's fine. It's fine. Yeah.
Check this out. This is pretty cool. Lon Strickler over at Phantoms and Monsters recently posted this. And if you've never been to Phantoms and Monsters, I really suggest you go check it out. He's always got cool stories on there. And he talks about how he recently received the following account. And it goes like this. My wife and I were visiting with my aunt and uncle in their home in 2013. They have a farm in southeast Manitoba. We were staying in the attic bedroom that looks out over the property. On the first morning, I was looking out the window around dawn and saw an animal running across the field. It was difficult to see, but I soon realized that it was a large dog or wolf. As I watched, it literally rose up on its back legs and walked. I soon lost sight of the animal as it headed towards the woods. I mentioned this to my aunt during breakfast, and she smiled and said nothing. That was odd because she always had something to say about just about anything. My wife was surprised by her non-reaction as well. So, later that day, I caught up with my uncle in the barn and told him what I had seen. He said that he had known that there were wolves in the area and that he'd hear howling occasionally, but he hadn't seen one in many years. Then I mentioned the wolf that stood up on 2 feet and ran. He just said that he supposed it was possible and didn't seem very interested, so I didn't say anything about it anymore. I have been reading about the Dogman stories on your blog, and now I begin to wonder if that may have been what I saw. More importantly, what my uncle recently saw on his farm. He and my aunt stayed with us during the Christmas holidays a few weeks ago. My uncle and I were in the living room talking when he said that 3 of his goats had recently gone missing. There was no trace of blood or any evidence, though the gate had been opened. Then he asked me if I remembered the wolf I had seen when we were there visiting with them. Sure, I remembered, but I hadn't thought much about it. He described an incident a few weeks back when he heard strange noises around the barn at night and decided to go out to investigate. He said that he swears that he saw a huge wolf on 2 legs run around the barn and into the field. It must have been over 2.5 meters tall. He hadn't said anything to my aunt, but when the goats went missing, he told her what he had seen. He was so concerned that he had a friend watching the farm while he and my aunt were down here visiting us. I called him a few days ago, and he said that nothing else has happened, but neither he or my aunt will go out of the house after dark. I told him about what I have been reading about, and I would like for him to contact you if possible. So what a crazy story is that. Now, Lon goes on to talk about that the guy's uncle has since sent him an email, and he went into a little bit more detail about the upright wolf that he saw, and that it had an unusually larger head than normal, and it had a tapered body, and it also looked like it had human-like arms and legs. And so, this sounds much like so many other possible dogman sightings. And of course, we've said it before, and I'll say it again. What could that be? It doesn't sound like a bear. It doesn't sound like anything that other than what is in a werewolf movie. That's what it looks like. Yeah. So, what a chilling story, especially if that's real, man.
If, like we always say, I don't think I want to see one. I don't want to find that out. I don't mind seeing Bigfoot. I don't want to see Dogman. Man, I'm good with that. I don't need any part of that.
I'm with you.
Folks, a lot of y'all have been texting and tweeting and messaging and sending all that stuff to us, and we've been looking at this. I'm going to bring this up to everybody that's been sending this whole thing. This is actually from USA Today. Scientists say that they may have new evidence in the D.B. Cooper case.
Oh.
They have done a little look around. It says that this comes up from, of course, this Seattle. It says a band of amateur scientists selected by the FBI to look for clues in the world's most infamous skyjacking may have found some new evidence, folks.
All right.
And they're actually asking for the public's help because of potential leads that could link the hijacker known as D.B. Cooper to the Puget Sound aerospace industry in the early 1970s. Now get a load of this here. It says the scientific team has been analyzing particles removed from the clip-on tie that was left behind by Mr. D.B. Cooper when he hijacked the plane there in November of 71. Now, we talked about it. They said he pulled it off. He left it down, you know, the whole deal. Well, there was a powerful electron microscope, and it said it found more than 100,000 particles on the old JCPenney tie. These particles include pure titanium, strontium sulfide, and cerium. Now, Tom Kay is the lead researcher for this group that calls itself Citizen Sleuths, and this is what he had to say. These are what they call rare earth elements. They are used in very narrow fields for very specific things. Well, Kay goes on to say that these elements were rarely used in 1971 during the time, of course, DB's little parachute escape. But he says that one place that they were actually being used was Boeing's high-tech supersonic transport plane, and it was being developed with government funding in the 60s and 70s. And Kay wonders if Cooper could have been a Boeing employee or a contractor who had actually wore that tie to work. And this is what he says. The tie went with him into these manufacturing environments for sure. So he was not one of the people running these manufacturing machines. He was either an engineer or a manager in one of these plants. And that's what he says. This is, I guess, kind of what he believes. Now, Kay goes on to say that Boeing was developing cutting-edge monitors, like radar screens, that use some of the elements found in this tie. And what he's asking for is the public's help, particularly, he said, from old-timers with experience in the aerospace industry in the Pacific Northwest. What he's asking for is they would like to hear theories from the public on what those materials could have been used for, and that they hope the information can help build a profile of D.B. Cooper. Now, Kay had this to say. Someone may be able to look at those particles and say, oh, my gosh, I know what that means, having those particles on the tie. Now, anybody that wants to get involved in this, you can go to their website. Just look up Citizen Sleuth website, and you can go to the contact tab. You click on that, and then you'll go, and you can go ahead and submit what your ideas would be. I have no idea what they would be doing. That is a heck of a thing that it's found. My only question is this. After all these years, how well preserved was that tie where it couldn't have been cross-contaminated with something else in and around that area? What all was in? Wasn't it supposed to be like an alleged explosion or something blew the door? I don't remember what all it was that went down. I don't know what could have gotten on the tie. I just question at how clean that tie was handled from the minute it come off of there till now. If there could have been a cross-contamination, but I don't know. And I also don't know what these 100,000 particles, is that a normal number? Is that a small number? Is that a very large number? I don't know enough about this kind of thing to really speak on that. But it is very interesting to me that they have found these, and they were like, this is rare earth elements, and it makes sense. It's not used that often in 1971, so where did he get this stuff on him at?
I don't know. They need to get in contact with Chael Sonnen. He's the one that says he knows who D.B. Cooper is.
We talked about it. Remember, we even played his interview, part of his interview. It is a, it's a great thing. So I wonder, what if that's what it was? What if one of the guys that they're looking at now may, or in the past, was like, wait a minute, this guy did work there. That's another little link. So it's one of those things. They may never know, or this may open up a whole new can of worms. It's just funny. It seems like you can never outrun it.
Yeah, right. Well, speaking of cryptozoology, when I did the Dog Man on the last story, I've got another one here, and it's about the Fontana monster sighting of 1966. And this was posted by our friend David Weatherly over on his website, Two Crows Paranormal. And it talks about how in August 1966, two teenagers rushed into the sheriff's office in Fontana, California, to report their close encounter with a strange creature. Jerry Lou Mendenhall, 16, told officers that she and her friend had been driving along a dirt road just north of town when a creature suddenly came out of the bushes and attacked the car. The creature reached through the driver's window and tried to grab Mendenhall. She quickly hit the accelerator and rushed away, but not before a hairy hand brushed against her. The girl showed officers a set of scratches on her neck, and she claimed to have received from the monster's large human-like hand. The witness described the beast as being at least 8 feet tall and like a gorilla on its hind legs. The youths were in hysterical state, and they described their encounter in great detail. The officers, however, were not receptive to the story and made fun of the teenagers. One official laughed and said to Mendenhall, "I suppose next you'll be telling me that the monster was dressed in a pink bikini. And you will expect me to believe that, too." Now, this just angered the girl who reported to the officer, and she said, "Sure, of course, it was wearing a pink bikini." Still in a distraught state, the teenagers left the office, trying to ignore the laughter of the police officers. Unfortunately, the pink bikini comment was picked up by a Los Angeles newspaper, which made further fun of the entire event. Several papers ran stories about Fontana's creature. The San Bernardino Sun-Telegram reported on the monster several times and included numerous witnesses and their statements. The Ontario Daily Report informed readers that there were numerous reports of the beast near the old Fontana drag strip between Foothill Boulevard and Baseline Road. According to the paper, the creature was a horrible monster with a hairy body, long hands, and claws dripping with slime. Now, by the end of August, the Daily Report ran a news item about an impromptu hunt for the monster. Sheriff's deputies were called out to reports of gunshots fired around the racetrack, and when upon arriving at the scene, they found four teenage boys with a pair of rifles who were combing the brush and shooting at everything that moved. The boys were reportedly determined to find the local monster and bring it down once and for all. Well, of course, the officers confiscated the firearms and sent the boys on their way. Now, that was the last reported of the Fontana Monster during that year. And while many people tried to play off the accounts as wild stories, the admission by a law enforcement officer himself that he found some unusual tracks implies there might be more to the story of Fontana's monster. So I find that very interesting. It appears to be a Sasquatch and stuff. And like they said, they thought it was teenagers, you know, probably just having fun and making stories. But one of the officers actually reported seeing some strange and unusual tracks. So it makes you wonder.
Yeah.
Back in 1966, you got to remember that part of California in 1966 was way less populated than it is now. And like we've talked about so many times, maybe something was moving around in the woods back then, or maybe still is.
Maybe still is out there, yeah.
I don't know. Well, let's take a break, folks. And when I get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about the Lost Franklin Expedition. Stick around. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Seafaring expeditions have always been dangerous, especially when headed to parts of the world that are unknown. This was no different during the 19th century. You see, not everyone who set out to discover new territories returned to tell the tale. In the case of Sir Franklin's Arctic Expedition of 1845, the crew set sail for the last unmapped section of the Northwest Passage. Little did the doomed sailors know that this frigid voyage into the Great White North would be their last. The search by Europeans for a western shortcut by sea from Europe to Asia began with the voyages of Christopher Columbus in 1492 and continued through the mid-19th century with a long series of exploratory expeditions originating mainly in England. These voyages, where only a small few were actually successful, helped to add to the sum of European geographic knowledge about the Western Hemisphere, particularly North America. And as that knowledge grew larger, attention gradually turned towards the Arctic. Voyagers of the 16th and 17th centuries who made geographic discoveries about North America included Martin Frobisher, John Davis, Henry Hudson, and William Baffin. In 1670, the incorporation of the Hudson's Bay Company led to further exploration of the Canadian coasts and the interior and of all the Arctic seas. In the 18th century, explorers included James Knight, Christopher Middleton, Samuel Hearne, James Cook, Alexander Mackenzie, and George Vancouver. By 1800, their discoveries showed conclusively that no Northwest Passage, navigable by ships, lay in the temperate latitudes between the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. In 1804, Sir John Barrow became second secretary of the Admiralty a post he held until 1845, and began to push by the Royal Navy to complete the Northwest Passage over the top of Canada and to navigate towards the North Pole. Over the next four decades, explorers including John Ross, David Buchan, William Edward Parry, Frederick William Beechey, James Clark Ross, George Back, and Peter Warren Deese, and Thomas Simpson, each made productive trips to the Canadian Arctic. Among these explorers was John Franklin, the man who this story focuses on. John Franklin was second in command of an expedition towards the North Pole in the ships Dorothea and Trent in 1818, and the leader of overland expeditions to and along the Arctic coast of Canada in 1819 through 1822, and again between 1825 and 1827. By 1845, the combined discoveries of all these expeditions had reduced the relevant unknown parts of the Canadian Arctic to a quadrilateral area of about 181,300 square kilometers, or 70,000 square miles. It was into this unknown area that Franklin was to sail. This is where he thought there still might be a Northwest Passage to the Pacific Ocean. Sir John Barrow, the second secretary of the Admiralty, who was 82 and nearing the end of his career, deliberated about who should command another expedition to complete the Northwest Passage and perhaps also find what Barrow believed to be an ice-free, open polar sea around the North Pole. Edward Parry was his first choice, but Parry said he was tired of the Arctic and politely declined. His second choice was James Clark Ross. He too declined because he had promised his new wife that he was done with the Arctic. Barrow's third choice was James Fitzjames, who agreed to do it, but was later rejected by the Admiralty on account of his young age. Barrow considered George Black, but thought that he was too argumentative. Francis Crozier was another possibility, and was of humble Irish birth, which counted against him. Reluctantly, Barrow settled on the 59-year-old John Franklin. The expedition was to consist of two ships, the HMS Erebus and the HMS Terror, each of which had seen Antarctic service with James Clark Ross. Fitzjames was given command of the Erebus, and Crozier, who had commanded Terror during the Antarctic expedition with Ross between 1841 and 1844, was appointed the executive officer and commander of the Terror. Franklin received his expedition command on February 7th, 1845, and his official instructions on May 5th, 1845. Erebus, at 378 tons, and Terror, at 331 tons, were sturdy built and were outfitted with recent innovations. Steam engines were fitted in the Erebus and Terror to drive a single screw inside each vessel. These engines were former locomotives from the London and Croydon Railway. They enabled the ships to make 7.4 kilometers an hour, or 4 knots, on their own power. Other advanced technologies included bows reinforced with heavy beams and plates of iron, an internal steam heating device for the comfort of the crew, screw propellers and iron rudders that could be withdrawn into the iron wells to protect them from damage. There was even a ship's library of more than 1,000 books and 3 years' worth of conventionally preserved or tinned food supplies. The food supplies were supplied from a provisioner, Stephen Goldner, who was awarded the contract on April 1st, 1845, a mere 7 weeks before Franklin set sail. Goldner worked frantically on the large and hasty order of 8,000 tins. The speed required affected quality control of a large portion of the tins manufactured, which were later found to have lead soldering that was thick and sloppily done and dripped like melted candle wax down the inside surface. Most of the crew were Englishmen, many of them from the North Country, with a small number of Irishmen and Scotsmen. Aside from Franklin, Crozier, and Lieutenant Graham Gore, the only other officers who were Arctic veterans were an assistant surgeon and two ice masters. The expedition set sail from Greenhithe, England, on the morning of May 19, 1845, with a crew of 24 officers and 110 men. The ships stopped briefly in Stromness Harbor in the Orkney Islands in northern Scotland, and from there they sailed to Greenland with the HMS Rattler and a transport ship, Barreto Jr. At the Whalefish Islands in Disko Bay, on the west coast of Greenland, 10 oxen carried by transport ship were slaughtered for fresh meat. Supplies were transferred to Erebus and Terror. The crew members wrote their last letters home. Letters written on board told how Franklin had banned swearing and drunkenness, and several of the crew did not care for Captain Franklin. Before the expedition's final departure, 5 men were discharged and sent home on the Rattler and the Barreto Jr., reducing the ship's final crew size to 129. The expedition was last seen by Europeans in late July 1845, when Captain Dannett of the whaler Prince of Wales and Captain Robert Martin of the whaler Enterprise encountered Terror and Erebus in Baffin Bay, waiting for good conditions to cross to Lancaster Sound. Over the next 150 years, other expeditions, explorers, and scientists would piece together what happened next. Franklin's men wintered in 1845 to 1846 on Beachy Island, where 3 crew members died and were buried. Terror and Erebus became trapped in ice off King William Island in September 1846 and never sailed again. According to a note dated April 28, 1848, and left on the island by FitzJames and Crozier, Franklin had died on June 11, 1847. The crew had wintered on King William Island in 1846 to 1847 and 1847 to 1848, and the remaining crew had planned to begin walking on April 26, 1848, toward the Back River on the Canadian mainland. 3 years into Franklin's expedition, and 24 men had now died from hypothermia, malnourishment, and exposure to the elements. The remaining 105 men would perish on their last ditch trek across the Canadian tundra, hundreds of miles from civilization. Their fates, however, would not be known for many years to come. After 2 years had passed, with no word from Franklin, public concern grew, and Lady Franklin, as well as members of Parliament and British newspapers, urged the Admiralty to send a search party. In response, the Admiralty developed a 3-pronged plan put into effect in the spring of 1848 that sent an overland rescue party, led by Sir John Richardson and John Ray, down the Mackenzie River to the Canadian Arctic coast. 2 expeditions by sea were also launched, one entering the Canadian Arctic archipelago through Lancaster Sound, and the other entering from the Pacific side. In addition, the Admiralty offered a reward of £20,000. Of course, in today's terms, that's £1,811,000. To any party or parties of any country who shall render assistance to the crews of the Discovery ships under the command of Sir John Franklin. After the 3-pronged effort failed, British national concern and interest in the Arctic increased until finding Franklin became nothing less than a crusade. Ballads such as Lady Franklin's Lament, commemorating Lady Franklin's search for her lost husband, became popular. Many joined the search. In 1850, 11 British and 2 American ships cruised the Canadian Arctic, including Breadalbane and her sister ship, the HMS Phoenix. Several converged off the east coast of Beachy Island, where the first relics of an expedition were found, including remnants of a winter camp from 1845 to 1846, and the graves of John Torrington, John Hartnell, and William Brienne. No messages from the Franklin expedition were found at the site. In the spring of 1851, passengers and crew aboard several ships observed a huge iceberg off Newfoundland, which bore two vessels, one upright and one on its beam ends. The ships were not examined closely, and it was later suggested that the ships could have been the Erebus and the Terror, though it is more likely that they were just abandoned whaling ships. In 1852, Edward Belcher was given command of the Government Arctic Expedition in search of Sir John Franklin. This was unsuccessful. Belcher's inability to render himself popular with his subordinates was peculiarly unfortunate in the Arctic voyage, and he was not wholly suited to command vessels among ice. Four of the five ships, the HMS Resolute, Pioneer, Assistance, and Intrepid, were abandoned in pack ice, for which Belcher was court-martialed but acquitted. One of those ships, the HMS Resolute, was later discovered intact by an American whaler. Timbers from the ship were later used to manufacture three desks, one of which, the Resolute Desk, was presented by Queen Victoria to the U.S. President Rutherford B. Hayes. It is often used today by presidents for use in the Oval Office and the Capitol's White House. In 1854, John Ray, while surveying the Boothia Peninsula for the Hudson Bay Company, discovered further evidence of the lost men's fate. Ray met an Inuit near Pelly Bay on 21st of April, 1854, who told him of a party of around 35 to 40 white men who had died of starvation near the mouth of the Back River. Another Inuit confirmed this story, which included reports of cannibalism among the dying sailors. The Inuit showed Ray many objects that were identified as having belonged to Franklin and his men. In particular, Ray bought from the Pelly Bay Inuit several silver forks and spoons, later identified as belonging to FitzJames, Crozier, Franklin, and Robert Osmer Sargent, a shipmate aboard the Erebus. Ray's report was sent to the Admiralty, which, in October 1854, urged the HBC to send an expedition down the Back River to search for other signs of Franklin and his men. Next were Chief Factor James Anderson and HBC employee James Stewart, who traveled north by canoe to the mouth of the Back River. In July 1855, a band of Inuit told them of a group of whites who had starved to death along the coast. In August, Anderson and Stewart found a piece of wood inscribed with Erebus and another that said Mr. Stanley, who was a surgeon aboard the Erebus on Montreal Island in Chantry Inlet, where the Back River meets the sea. Despite the findings of Ray and Anderson, the Admiralty did not plan another search of its own. Britain officially labeled the crew as deceased in service on March 31st, 1854. Lady Franklin, failing to convince the government to fund another search, personally commissioned one more expedition under Francis Leopold McClintock. The expedition ship, the steam schooner Fox, bought via public subscription, sailed from Aberdeen on July 2nd, 1857. In April 1859, sledge parties set out from Fox to search on King William Island, and on May 5th, the party led by Royal Navy Lieutenant William Hobson found a document in a cairn left by Crozier and FitzJames. It contained two messages. The first, dated May 28, 1847, said that the Erebus and Terror had wintered in the ice off the northwest coast of King William Island and had wintered earlier at Beachy Island after circumnavigating Cornwallis Island. Sir John Franklin commanding the expedition, all well, the message said. The second message, written in the margins of that same sheet of paper, was much more ominous. Dated April 25th, 1848, it reported that Erebus and Terror had been trapped in ice for a year and a half, and that the crew had abandoned the ships on April 22nd. 24 officers and crew had died, including Franklin, on June 11, 1847, just 2 weeks after the date of the first note. Crozier was now commanding the expedition, and the 105 survivors planned to start out the next day, heading south towards the Back River. The McClintock expedition also found a human skeleton on the southern coast of King William Island. Still clothed, it was searched, and some papers were found, including a seaman's certificate for Chief Petty Officer Henry Pegler, Captain of the Foretop, HMS Terror. However, since the uniform was that of a ship's steward, it's more likely that the body was that of Thomas Armitage, a gunroom steward on the HMS Terror and a shipmate of Peglar, whose papers he was just carrying. At another site, on the western extreme of the island, Hobson discovered a lifeboat containing two skeletons and relics from the Franklin expedition. In the boat was a large amount of abandoned equipment, including boots, silk handkerchiefs, scented soap, sponges, some slippers, a few hair combs, and many books. McClintock also took testimony from the Inuit about the expedition's disastrous end. Two expeditions between 1860 and 1869 by Charles Francis Hall, who lived among the Inuit near Frobisher Bay on Baffin Island, and later at Repulse Bay on the Canadian mainland, found camps, graves, and relics on the southern coast of King William Island. But none of the Franklin expedition survivors he believed would be found among the Inuit. Though he concluded that all of the Franklin crew were dead, he believed that the official expedition records would yet be found under a stone cairn. With the assistance of his guides, Eberling and Tukulito, Hall gathered hundreds of pages of Inuit testimony. Among these materials are accounts of visits to Franklin's ships and an encounter with a party of white men on the southern coast of King William Island near Washington Bay. Despite knowing that the expedition was a disaster and that some of its crew members lay buried in the ice, many of the details surrounding the ill-fated voyage remained shrouded in mystery. Searches, excavations, and exploratory expeditions continued well into the 1870s, with little results. Bodies exhumed on King William Island revealed cut marks in the bone, suggesting cannibalism. In the early 1980s, scientists once more grew curious over the lost Franklin expedition and began searching anew. The most recent search by a Canadian team announced in 2014 that it had located and verified the wreckage of the HMS Erebus, one of the lost ships. The wreck was designated as a National Historic Site of Canada, and its precise location remains hidden from the public. So, what must it have been like to be one of the men aboard the HMS Erebus or the HMS Terror? How long into their journey did they know that they were doomed? Everyone's been cold before. Even if you're lucky enough to live in an area where it never gets cold or snows, certainly you've walked inside a walk-in cooler before. Being cold is terrible. It's demoralizing. Now imagine being stuck hundreds of kilometers from God knows where, lost in the wilderness, your ships frozen solid in the sea ice. Everywhere you look, it's blinding white with snow. I can only imagine that the men instantly, knowing that this was going to be very bad. How do we get out of here? How long will it take? Which direction do we go? How long will the provisions last? For more than 2 years, the men fought off death, but ultimately they all died. I think the ones who died first, they probably had it easier than the ones who clinged on for another 2 years. The next time you're alone, and it's cold and quiet, Think of the Franklin expedition and the men who died spread out across the Canadian tundra. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I love stories like this. For whatever reason, these expeditions to unknown parts of the world, it's kind of romantic to think about, because now, with satellites and everything, you can go on Google Earth and you can look at any corner of the Earth you want to. But you got to remember a time not too long ago. I mean, 1800s was not that long ago, where there were still vast parts of the world that were unexplored. And so... You think about how terrifying it would be nowadays, but I can only imagine back then to go out on an expedition. You're miles from God knows what.
Mm-hmm.
You're stranded. Your boats get frozen in solid ice. You're stuck. There's nowhere for you to go. And who knows how long it's going to be before it thaws and you can move.
Yeah.
So now you're stuck. You're limited provisions. You're talking about the frozen tundra of the Arctic. I mean, there's no trees. There's no nothing. That's why polar bears are about the only thing that survive up there. Some foxes and seals. Right. Outside of that, there's not a whole lot out there. And of course, they started succumbing to starvation and malnutrition and stuff. And of course, it looks like some of them succumbed to cannibalism, but you can hardly blame them.
No,
I mean, if somebody gets pneumonia or whatever and dies and the rest of y'all are starving, I mean, wouldn't it be better to eat the guy? I mean, you gotta.
I don't think you could stop yourself. I honestly don't think you could. What do they call it? Long pig. I don't think you could stop yourself from eating that. I really don't.
I don't think you could either.
Well, and it's also one of those things like you bring up. It's a very romantic notion of adventure. And we talk about it all the time because I think everyone that listens to this show has a bit of an adventurer soul or spirit in them, because that's the reason you care for these stories. I mean, we all really enjoy these tales and rehashing these old things, is because today it's hard to find that kind of true adventure. It's one thing to set out on the road to do something, or take a little trip, or I've been watching these people in these van life where they convert vans and just live in vans for 2 or 3 years and just travel around and see things. That's one type of adventure, but it's not the same type of adventure as it is when you go into the Arctic just to try to explore and see what nobody else has ever seen.
And you don't even know what's up there.
Well, you're right. And the odds of coming home are slim to none, or none in this case. I mean, you go through these things.
It's not like you had a sat phone. You can call home. I mean, when you're stuck, you're stuck.
And I can't imagine it having, I mean, we don't have the same kind of, you don't get to run by REI and gather up all your outdoor gear before you head off on that whole thing. So I can't imagine you have good gear when you get up. I mean, you have the best at the time, but their best at the time would be a joke compared to what we have now.
And say you want to start walking like they decided to do ultimately. I mean, which direction do you go? Do you go back the same way you just came? Because you never know. There might be a town just 2 miles in front of you, and you're going to go the other way. You have no idea really where to go. Once you decide which direction you're going to start walking, well, how much provisions do you need to take? How long? You don't know how long the journey's going to be.
That's a very terrifying ideal once you sit down and really start thinking about it.
It sounds like they basically just kind of hung out there for 2 years.
Just waiting to die.
Hopefully waiting for someone to come along and find them, which only ones that ever had any contact with them were Inuits. Local natives that lived in the area, but they didn't really do much trading with them. They were just like, what are these white people doing up here?
I can't imagine that. I can't imagine the hopelessness feeling that you would get that sunk in after all that time. You're like, we're probably not getting out of this one, man. We come up here and, like we said, you got that adventurous spirit, but then it's just not enough.
Terrifying. Yeah. Well, before we get out of here, let's talk about our sponsors.
Heck yeah, let's talk about them. I've got you something here, folks. I know, surely most of you have probably gone and at least checked out Gaia.com, G-A-I-A.com. I've got something cool here. If you haven't read any of his books, Michael Tellinger has written some really great books on basically humanity's origins and some ancient origins, and he covers things from the Anunnaki. This is a little treat that you're going to get right now. The first two episodes of his series about Hidden Origins by Michael Tellinger are actually up on Gaia.com for free right now. Episode one's Humanity's Hidden Origins. Episode two is The Power of Gold. I suggest you go check those out. When you get into it and you start listening to it and some cool history and stuff, it's going to draw you in, and then you can jump on there and give it a whirl. See what you find out. Like we said, there's plenty of ways to sign up. There's plenty of stuff to see. Thousands, like over 7,000 titles, folks, of all this ancient origins and secrets and cover-ups and unexplained metaphysics. You can dig into there. They even have one that I've not got to watch yet, but I'm going to. It's called Forbidden Archaeology, and it's with Michael Cremo, the man that wrote the book. And I actually have the book, the whole thing, things I'm drawn into. So, folks, if you've got Apple TV, if you've got a Roku, if you've just got the little Comcast, Android phones, anywhere you want to go, go sign up, check it out. It's fun, it's cheap, and you can just dig in and go crazy. If you're into the stuff listening to this, you're going to be into that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really cool. I enjoy it. Like I said, I really enjoyed the Deep Space series that's over there. It's like Ancient Aliens.
I hear about this on the reg, folks. But when I first met Kyle, as young Mint, he was really hooked on all the Nova series on PBS and all the Carl Sagan and all this stuff from the cosmos. So it's not changed. He's gotten older, folks. He's got a little bit less hair. None of that other stuff has changed. Everything that has to do with deep space, he's all about it.
I'd also like to talk about for a moment our sponsor, Blue Apron. Now, you may have heard me mention it during the beginning of the show. Most of you probably already know what Blue Apron is because you've probably heard it before on other podcasts or radio stations. But for those of you that don't know what it is, let me tell you about it. Blue Apron is a fresh ingredient delivery service. And what that means is they ship delicious meals to your doorstep. And all you have to do is cook it. Now, everyone's lives are super busy, even more so if you've got kids. I mean, in my house, me and my wife both work full-time jobs, and we also have kids, and there's things that they have to do outside of school, like baseball. And with the podcast twice a week, my schedule is always full. And I'm sure a lot of you out there are the exact same way. Everyone wants to eat healthy. We talk about it all the time. But let's be honest, Cam, it takes time and work to prepare healthy meals for you or your partner or your family. And when you work all day and then run the kids around and do the chores, take out the trash, whatever, by the time you get home and everything's done, you're beat. You're tired. I get it. So it's very easy to get sloppy, to get lazy and decide to eat out, you know, to pick up some McDonald's or pick up a pizza. And that's okay every once in a while, but not every week. That's where Blue Apron comes in. You see, they take a lot of the work out of making a good, healthy meal for you and your family. You just simply go to their website, you look at the menu, which changes every single week throughout the year. And depending on the plan you choose, 2 to 4 times a week, when you get home, there'll be a cooler box sitting on your front porch. Inside is everything you need to make the meal. A healthy meal. Cam, tell them what some of these recipes are.
Well, for upcoming, folks, if you want to choose the two-people plan, upcoming in this week, you're going to have West African peanut chicken you could get. Roasted cauliflower steaks. I'm a big fan of that. I love the cauliflower steaks. I looked into the family plan, folks, and I found a little winner here, folks. Cauliflower Parmesan paninis. Look, I love any kind of little Parmesan stuff. So, yeah, this is going to be one of those deals that, like you said, it's hard enough to do it healthy and to find the time. This is going to be perfect.
Yeah, Blue Apron does this by, you know, they're partnering with lots of farmers who raise only the highest quality ingredients. And they're working with other experts to create better standards for growing and raising animals. They're already partnered with over 150 different farms. So the big question is, what's this going to cost me? Well, not as much as you think. Like Cam said, there's two different plans. The two-person plan, if you choose to do that, you get 3 meals a week. It's $9.90 a serving, or a total of $59.94 a week. Now, you're saying $60 seems a little high, but not really. Imagine if two people went out to eat at a restaurant for 3 nights. Don't you think the total would be way more than $60?
It depends on which. If you went to a good restaurant, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then the family plan, you can choose either 2 meals or 4 meals a week, and that comes down to $8.74 per serving. So if you go with the 2 meals a week, it's $69.92. If you go with the 4 meals, it's $139.84. Either way, I don't think you could feed a whole family 4 times for $130, at least not in my house. Our grocery bill is outstanding. We have like $1,100 a month just on grocery bills. It's still, we never have enough. The twins suck down a gallon of milk like every 2 days.
Exactly. It's something we don't think about. People don't think about this. I'm glad they approached us. They came to us. This is a very interesting thing. I'm looking forward to really spending a few weeks and seeing what all I get.
Yeah, I tried it out. Me and Delete. My wife loves to cook. Yeah. She's an excellent cook. That's one of the reasons I married her. She's a very good cook. But even her, when she gets, you know, after work, so if you get tired and then you have to put together all the ingredients, you got to plan what you're going to cook that day. You got to remember, oh man, I forgot to set out the kitchen. The
and
chicken.
I love food
it's
anyway.
Frozen. So. These are really good meals. They tell you how to do it. And maybe you want to get into cooking. Like, you're not very good at cooking. Imagine if you practice cooking new meals that you've never done before 3 times a week for an entire year. By the end of that, you're going to be pretty good.
Yeah.
Shipping is always free. You can skip any week you want to, and you can cancel any time. All new chefs get $30 off your first delivery. Go check it out, blueapron.com. If you have any interesting stories you'd like to share with Expanded Perspectives, don't forget you can always email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show, 817-945-3828. And if you don't want to type out your story, you can leave it on the voicemail. Now, me and Kim, of course, aren't sitting here in studio to answer the phone. It's going to be a recording, but you can leave it on there, and we would love to hear your story. What are you talking about? What are you laughing at over there?
Don't forget, too, our jiu-jitsu instructor, our professor, Mr. Dondi Morgan, he actually has a little match coming up. For those of you that want to see the people that we train with, he's competing on the Fight to Win Pro in Dallas this weekend. And not just him, but one of the ladies that I train with, Anna, she's going to be there. Miss Anna Snyder's going to be competing on there. And then our buddy, the Honey Sloth. We've talked about him before. He won the last time they put him on. They brought him back again. The one and only Dakota Ranallo, the man I did his wedding. He is competing. They give him a week's notice, and he's going up against a fella named Wally, that they call him the Walrus. And Dakota texts me out of the blue, and he's like, looks like the Honey Sloth going up against the Walrus.
What do we know about the Walrus? What belt is he?
I think they're both purples. I don't know. He may be a brown. I don't know. But I know that Dakota's purple, the whole thing. So I would assume he's a purple belt, the whole deal. I think Dakota should have got a submission of the night for the purple belts last time. I know he's going for it again this time. So if you want to, folks, if you get a wild hair and you just got nothing else to go, you can go on the Fight to Win. I believe Flo Grappling actually carries it. So for like $10, you can watch a month's worth of grappling, and it's going to be on there. But it's going to be next week, I believe, next Friday. So you can go in and watch at least those three compete and go, we might get to go. I don't know. I'm looking around to try to get to go. I know they got a bunch of tables, so we might be on the TV. I have no clue. You might be able to see us. You might not. I don't know yet. But anyway, big shout out to all of them. Do well, my friends.
Speaking of jiu-jitsu, one of my all-time favorites, BJ Penn, Baby James, is going to be competing this Sunday in the UFC. I'm looking forward to that. I just love that guy. I haven't seen him in the cage. I think it's been like 6 years since he's fought.
We're recording this on Sunday, Matt, folks, and as soon as we get done, we're going to watch so we can watch him compete.
I cannot wait. I love BJ Penn.
I love BJ Penn.
You got anything planned else for the week other than the jiu-jitsu match?
No, not so much. I think they're going to release my mother to full weight bearing on her leg, which means that she will be able to get out and do more, which means when I say get out, I mean get out of my hair, get out of my house, maybe go do some other things. We took her out for her birthday this weekend. She turned 66. She's up and moving around. She's been in a great mood. So all I've got to do is get all that stuff squared away, make sure she's covered, the whole deal. That's about all I got. What about you, man? Besides work and besides us recording another show, what are you going to be doing?
Just working, because I'm going to be taking a family trip. I'm going to be snow skiing or snowboarding in an undisclosed mountainous area somewhere in the middle of the United States, in the mountains of the Rocky Mountains. Just working to do that. You know, it never fails whenever we plan a vacation. It seems like always, right, but I can be slow.
You beat all I've ever seen.
Every time I plan a trip, I can plan a trip 2 years. It never without fail, when it gets close to me leaving for that trip, I get swamped. And that's exactly what I'm experiencing now. I haven't had a day off in like 10 days. I'm not complaining. I'm working through it, because I'm going to take off, and for 5 or 6 days, I'm not going to do nothing.
I've been waiting. I'm also
waiting to
see. I'm
going to drink my beer and try to get hungry.
Right. I'm also waiting to see how it hits us before we go to Arkansas, because I know you're probably going to get hammered again. We did last year. It was running real smooth. Kyle wasn't working, and all of a sudden, boom, we get ready to plan, and it just piles up. We had to leave late because of his work. So
I forgot about that. The internet crapped out, and I couldn't leave because I had to wait for the charter guy to get here.
Yeah,
exactly. Because my family, you know, first world problems, they were freaking out. Well, you're leaving. You can't go out of town for 3 days. We can't survive without the internet.
Yeah, come on, Dad.
So I had to wait for that. You know, yeah, God knows you can't live stream with your iPads. They don't forget the that just like 4 years ago. That didn't even exist.
First world problems.
Anyways, I hope everybody out there has a good week. Be careful. Be safe. Be nice to one another. We'll speak to you elite members on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you again next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Much love from Texas, y'all. Peace.